to the Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Dateline, Friday, April 13th, Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm hoping you've had no bad luck on Friday the 13th. Thus far, I haven't, and I hope you are all doing well. Max Armstrong and Orion Samuelson, our weekly visit and our look at Wall Street to see what's going to happen next. And it's happening. We've gone from trade war talk with China and other countries, and this week the market talked about Syria and chemical warfare and the chance of Russia getting involved in that. It's enough to make a grown man cry. But let's look at what happened on Wall Street today. The financial stocks did lead a drop on Wall Street as results from big banks failed to excite the traders, and the fear of a broader conflict in Syria further unnerved investors. Wells Fargo today sank 3.4% after the bank said it may have to pay a penalty of $1 billion to resolve investigations. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, the biggest U.S. bank, dropped 2.7%. And the Wells Fargo said it may have to pay a penalty of $1 billion to resolve investigations. It sank 3.4%. Citigroup dropped 1.6% despite beating the estimates of profit by Wall Street. But one trader said the renewed possibility of a strike in Syria is enough to cause heartburn for the market. He said there's a ton of uncertainty right now, so investors don't want to go into the weekend particularly long. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 123 points today, ending the week at 24,360. The S&P 500 lost 7 points, ending the week at 2656, and the NASDAQ Composite dropped 33 points to end the week at 7106. Despite all that, for the week, the S&P 500 rose 2%. The Dow gained 1.75%, and the NASDAQ added 2.75%. Friday's bank results kicked off earnings season with Thomson Reuters data predicting profits at the S&P 500 companies increased by 18.6% in the first quarter from a year ago. And if that's the case, when the quarter ends, their biggest rise in 7 years. But while the U.S. economy is performing well, geopolitical issues are weighing on stock markets this year. Senior Russian lawmaker said today the lower house of parliament would consider draft legislation giving the Kremlin powers to ban or restrict a list of U.S. imports, reacting to new U.S. sanctions on Russian tycoons and officials. Boeing fell 2.4% today after a Russian lawmaker said the country may stop supplying titanium to the company. And also issues with the engines for Boeing 787 Dreamliner planes also weighed on the company's shares. Today, Tesla up 2.1% after founder Elon Musk said the electric car maker would be profitable in the third and fourth quarters and would not need to raise money this year. So anyway, with the big banks reporting today, the earnings report season is underway. And do you remember the time when the earnings report season was always led off by Alcoa Aluminum? Well, that's changed because aluminum producer Alcoa now will be reporting on Wednesday, expected to report higher quarterly revenue led by improving alumina and aluminum prices. Steel and aluminum companies are expected to benefit from President Trump's imposition of hefty tariffs on metal imports to protect the U.S. companies from foreign competition. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve will issue its so-called Beige Book, a compendium of anecdotes on the health of the economy, taken from the central bank sources across the nation. And once again, the Federal Reserve Bank governors are going to be busy on the speaking circuit this year and making some stops on Capitol Hill. Also, this coming week on Tuesday, building permits for March expected to show a reading of 1,328,000. That would be slightly above February. Housing starts are expected to come in at 1,269,000 for March. And later in the day, industrial production data likely to show a 0.3% increase. On Thursday, weekly jobless claims data will likely show the number dip to 230,000 from the 233,000 reported last week. Now, let's look at some of the earnings reports. General Electric Company expected to report a drop in first quarter revenue and profit, partly hurt by weakness at the power business, a unit that produced 60% of its profits as recently as 2016. The results will follow a sharp decline in 2017 profit for the U.S. industrial conglomerate. On the same day, Honeywell International, which makes everything from jet engines to thermostats, expected to report higher profit and revenue for the first quarter, led by increased sales in its aerospace unit, which is its biggest business. And then Procter & Gamble, the world's biggest household products maker, expected to report a higher profit in the third quarter on Friday, driven by higher sales of innovative products, including Tide Pods and Pampers diaper pants, as well as a strong beauty products business. American Express Company is expected to report an increase in profit when it reports first quarter results on Wednesday, helped by growth in the credit card loans. However, rewards-related costs could be a concern for the credit card issuer. United Health Group, the largest U.S. health insurer that is currently negotiating a contract with medical service provider Envision Healthcare, expected to report an increase in first quarter profit on Tuesday. Oil field services firm Schlumberger releases results for its first quarter of 2018 on Friday. And the oil field services provider is expected to report an increase in profit, helped basically by higher North American activity. IBM expected to report an increase in quarterly revenue once again, after posting its first revenue growth in nearly 6 years in the previous quarter. However, profit is expected to decline. United Continental Holdings will report first quarter financial results after the market closes on Tuesday. The first quarter report comes as the airline industry is fighting off increased competition by low-cost carriers in some of its hubs by lowering fares and raising capacity. We'll also hear from Johnson & Johnson, which has been shedding assets to focus on more profitable business, but it's expected to report higher first quarter profit on Tuesday. Blackstone Group, the world's largest manager of alternative assets, reports earnings for the first quarter of 2018 on Thursday. CSX Corporation, the third largest U.S. railroad, expected to report higher first quarter profit on Tuesday, partly boosted by benefits from new U.S. tax laws. And then on Thursday, the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, that's the world's largest custodian bank, expected to report a first quarter profit helped by lower tax rates, like most U.S. banks that have benefited from new tax laws. And on Tuesday, Omnicom Group will report first quarter results before the market opens. U.S. advertising company likely to report an increase in revenue and net income as client spending improves. So it's going to be a busy week on the earnings report front. One more, after a quarter dominated by tax reform, Charlotte, North Carolina-based Bank of America expected to report first quarter results as well. So it's going to be a busy week, and traders and investors will certainly have a lot to digest as the earnings reports now join the geopolitical situations to have its impact on Wall Street. Well, what about land prices? With the volatility in the stock market, apparently some people are turning to land as an investment. Max Armstrong will be joined by Ray Brownfield of LandPro to discuss the farmland value situation when we continue on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
What is land worth? We often ask that question, and visiting with us this weekend to talk about those prices, those markets, Ray Brownfield, LandPro LLC is the firm in Oswego, Illinois, also very involved for many years in the past in the leadership of the land appraisers, farmland managers, and rural appraisers. You guys still have that group, do you not?
We do. Yeah, we do. Very active.
Talk about, first of all, the farmland manager. He or she still is pretty doggone important in the whole scheme of agriculture, aren't they?
Well, we feel we are. We offer a service to people who are absentee landowners, investors, people who really, they love agriculture, wouldn't be in it, but they don't have the time sometimes to be involved in every day-to-day business involving the leasing, the grain marketing, the conservation practices, all the technology today that's really developing at a rapid rate in agriculture, which is great. And so they retain professionals like ourselves to be of assistance to them, to help them really continue with their farming, the good farming practices, and, of course, to add to the income levels they hope and long-term valuation. That's really important to most people on land today.
The farm manager is a partner with the farmer. But I think sometimes there's a perception that it's an adversarial relationship. Is it, Ray?
It really never – well, we hope it's not. It's not intended to be that way. Most farmers that we work with, we see them as business partners. Where I say partners, I use that very carefully because certainly we don't represent that farmer. The owner-operator is who we work for. But we want a relationship to be really good with the farmers because we all think we all add something as a team to the ownership of that land. And that truly is what I found to be the most interesting part of my job after all these years is working with the farmers. I gain more from them than they do from me, I think, many times. The people are just really tremendous out there today and what they understand in technology and the genetics, all the things that they do. We bring, I think, an opportunity to them to add to the value of that farm sometimes in a way of adding tile. Lots of times owners don't understand the value of drainage and what that brings to mitigate the risk to that farm operator, but also adds value to the farm. And when it comes time to negotiate that rent, it's a little easier to talk to that farm operator and say, look, we're putting X amount of thousands of dollars into tile to help you mitigate your risk. Can you at least pay a little bit more for rent? And most people say, yeah, that makes sense to us. We're glad to work with you in that regard. So to me, it's really an important type of what I call business arrangement between all of us.
There is so much data being collected now on our farms. Is it generally being shared with that farmland manager? I mean, the producer has that data coming from the the acreage that he or she has there, and it's a variety of data all through the growing season. Is that, in most instances, then openly shared with that manager who's representing the landowner?
It truly is. In most cases, yes, I've run into a few cases where there was a reluctance to provide that, and then we have to understand how we all represent the best interests, again, of that owner. That information is important to us. Even if it's a cash rental lease, you would say, well, why do you need that? Well, because we're tracking the involvement of that farm into what it can really do in production, and that's important to us. And in the event someday, if that farm should ever sell, that's extremely good information to any potential buyer who wants to track the yields as well. The soil test, what's been done on the farm, as well as the pH, the limestone, those are things that are extremely important not only today but for the future. So those things that we do like to know. Now we're getting drone type videos ourselves. Actually, our company is getting a drone here soon, and we're going to be able to share that information with our owners and well as the operators if they don't have a drone. A lot of them have drones too, so it's getting to be really good information, I think, that's very helpful to all of us.
The owners, that's a rather diverse bunch. Some of those are people who may have grown up on a farm and inherited it. They may have not been involved in agriculture in any way, but they recognize that it could be a valuable part of their diverse portfolio to spread the risk in that portfolio. And some are the big funds. Are they still active in buying farmland?
They're active to the viewpoint of being extremely particular about what they buy and what returns they can generate. Because keep in mind, that's not their money. It's money coming from various sources. It could be colleges. It could be pension funds. It could be unions, other things of which there's lots of billions of dollars to be invested out there daily into different kinds of assets, some of which is a small portion goes into farmland these days, which is, I think, a really good thing because it gives them a good diversity. But the fact is that they have to have a certain return, or they just can't do it. And I would tell you that it varies from region to region, but here in the Midwest, where we're located here currently, 2.8% to 3% is about as low as they'll possibly go, and they'd rather have higher, but it's hard to get anything better than that. So we do work with some funds out there today, and it's enjoyable to work with them because they work with the local farmers through our professional farm management, and they're willing to put money back in the land to make it better, which I think is extremely good.
I can't imagine too many of those fund managers, though, have the long-term perspective that is necessary with land. You have to be a little bit patient there, recognizing that over the long haul it will do well, but as is often the case, they are demanded to return performance quarter to quarter.
Very, very true. Very accurate, Max. We do report them to the fund managers actually monthly and certainly quarterly on what's going on the farms. And they actually come out to visit them from time to time to make sure that we all understand what's doing the right thing for the fund, the people that brought the money to the table. So, yes, it's but we understand also it's at least a 10-year investment. It's a longer term. And at the end of 10 years, some of the farmland may go back into the marketplace. Some may not, but they understand clearly it's a long-term investment. It has to be or they shouldn't be in the market.
5 years into a downturn of the farm economy, one could imagine that might be forcing some farmers to not buy land, to back out of that market a little bit. After we saw those robust years around 2012-13, we saw the farmers still continuing to buy. Are they now, after all this time, Ray?
They still are. I think that statistically, 62% that we found here in the Midwest are in buying farmland. 60% of all buyers. That's a pretty big number. But I would tell you, it's not the frenzy it was back in 2013 when we had a drought and we had the real high prices where there was more expendable income to come in the marketplace. They, too, are being much more careful about what they buy. But they're still out there, and that makes sense because the farmers, the owner-operators, look at it as a long-term investment for them and their families and hopefully their grandchildren if they can do some really good estate planning. And I think that's a wonderful thing. That's where we like to see it with the farm families. And so we still see them there, particularly if it should go to auction. It's interesting if it's a 40 or an 80 or a smaller piece next to several farmers of whom hopefully they'll see each other in church and be happy. But on the other hand, they may be very competitive when it comes time to buy that land, and they're going to be there if it's good quality ground that makes sense to their addition to their currently asset balance.
You mentioned auction. We have heard of folks exiting this business, and some simply weren't able to manage their risk effectively in a very, very risky climate these days. How much of that is happening out there to put land in play?
We hear of it. It's not as great as some would think. I think, and they really probably most times it's very private. If a farm operator, owner operator has become stretched and financially speaking, his creditor says, "Hey, look, we need some liquidity. We can't continue." Then what he will probably, he or she will go to people locally and say, "You know, I've got this 40 and 80. I know you'd probably like to add it." They like a lease back if they can get it. Sometimes they can't. But generally, it's something, and I can understand it should be very private. People are not happy to have to do it to begin with. And so if they do, they hope they can go to somebody local or a local investor who may say, "Yeah, I know you well. I'll buy it. I'll lease it back to you." And that'll hopefully solve your issues out there. Very few that we know have gone to auction at this point. There could be that. I think if, you know, we don't know what will happen in 2018. We hope it's going to be a decent year. But I think their people are stretched. I think there's happened, and I think some of the fellows maybe paid a little more in their business model for cash rent, and maybe they could. Mm-hmm. Maybe they bought more machinery than they should have. So we're going to see a little of that, and we just hope they come out okay.
I was with a young couple sometime in the past 45 to 60 days, and they were in a situation where a longtime farmer, veteran farmer, decided it was time to leave the business. He had no heirs, and he set them up. He came to them and said, "I want you to have this farm." And you know, there were almost tears in their eyes as they were telling me about this. I almost cried listening to them. That's a rare thing, but there are many instances where farmers will target a younger producer. Am I not right about that, Ray?
You're absolutely correct. We see it from time to time, and it is a very emotional thing for me as well, Max, to see that because, you know, I'm a farm boy like you. That's where we're born and raised. That's where our hearts still are. And to see that opportunity happen, it's wonderful because it's hard for the young farmer or family to get started today without that kind of help, without inheritance, without something to get them going because, one, it's highly competitive to get more land. It's really any farms we have that come up for rent, we have a list of people. It's not a problem getting them rented. And the cost of machinery and just the cost of inputs are tremendous. So I hope that if that should be the case for people who have no other place to go, that they do look, because there's some really good young farmers. Yeah. I mean, today we're blessed to see some of them, and we're fortunate in our company to work with some that are, I think, outstanding young people, just outstanding.
I think this was the case where this elderly gentleman had watched these two grow up in church and watched them through school, and he knew what they were capable of and knew their ethic of caring for the land, and that's exactly what he wanted to see.
Thank you very much, Max, and our thanks also to Ray Brownfield of LandPro LLC for joining us on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
A couple of big surprises in the agricultural commodity world this week, both of them coming from Argentina. On Tuesday of this week, Argentina booked its largest import purchase of U.S. soybeans in 20 years, aimed at solving their drought problems that cut production in the world's number three soybean exporter and top supplier of soy meal and soy oil. On Tuesday, USDA confirmed the private sales of 120,000 tons of U.S. soybeans to Argentina for shipment in the 2018-19 marketing year. And the sale represented the largest volume of U.S. soybeans sold to Argentina, which is a major soy producer, since December of 1997. But it's all because of the drought in Argentina that, according to a crop reporting service in that country, has dropped the size of the production for this year to 37 million tons. A lot of that they had already sold to foreign buyers, and now they have to come to the U.S. for soybeans to get enough to fulfill those contracts with the foreign buyers. And so it's a problem for Argentina, and they're turning to the U.S. for help on that one. So that was surprise number one. And then surprise number two came today. U.S. pork will be imported into Argentina for the first time since 1992 under newly finalized technical and safety rules. That word from the U.S. Trade Representative's office, the technical requirements implement a deal that was announced last August following a meeting between Argentine President Mauricio Macri and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence in Buenos Aires. Argentina had blocked imports of U.S. pork for about 26 years. They were concerned about some animal health concerns. Well, the deal could open up a potential $10 million per year market for U.S. pork producers. The United States, which is the world's leading pork exporter with global sales of $6.5 billion, exports about 27% of its pork production, making it highly dependent on foreign markets at a time when hog supplies are growing seasonally. So, two surprises this week from Argentina. And maybe another surprise from the White House. President Trump said Thursday his administration may allow the sale of gasoline containing 15% ethanol year-round, something that could help farmers by bolstering corn demand. The EPA currently bans the higher ethanol blend called E15 during the summer because of concerns it contributes to smog on hot days. Gasoline typically contains just 10% ethanol. But the president said at a meeting with governors and lawmakers at the White House, we're going to be going probably to 15, and we're going to be going to a 12-month period. We're going to work out something during the transition period, which is not easy. It is very complicated. And so that announcement from the White House and the EPA this week. Then there's been talk of the U.S. rejoining the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. So what's that story? President Trump said the United States would only join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a multinational trade deal that his administration walked away from last year, if it offered, quote, substantially better terms than those provided under previous negotiations. His comments made on Twitter late Thursday came only hours after he had unexpectedly indicated the United States might rejoin the landmark pact and amid heightened volatility in financial markets as Washington locked horns with China in a bitter trade dispute. After the United States withdrew from the agreement, the other countries involved, 11 of them, did sign the agreement and they're operating trade with each other, but the United States is not a part of that trade agreement. But who knows? That could change as well. So let's take a look at where we're going to start the week's trade on Monday. In the grain market, the July soybean contract will start at $4.90 a bushel after dropping 8.25 cents a bushel today. July corn will start the week at $3.93¾ after dropping 3.5 cents today. And the July soybean contract will start the week at $10.63 a bushel after dropping 8.75 cents a bushel in today's trade. As far as livestock is concerned, market didn't react to the Argentinian announcement as far as hog futures were concerned. But the live cattle contract for April did close up $1.32. Are up, and that put it at $117.07 a hundredweight. June cattle, however, down $0.50 at $103.65. Severe winter-like weather in the northern plains and already tight supplies in Nebraska did force processors to compete for cash cattle this week. Then we look at the hog market. April hog futures, which expired at noon today, we did see other contracts going higher following recent cash price gains, and some packers increased bids for hogs. So where do we start Monday in the livestock numbers? After a higher close today across the board, June lean hogs will start at $77.65, up 52 cents. And the April, the June live cattle contract, after gaining 40 cents today, will start at $104.92. April feeder cattle will start the week at $139.37 after gaining 72 cents a hundredweight today. Well, that's our time for another week. Thank you, as always, for joining us on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.